You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 74. Don't break your back finding money for a film, making a film, editing a film, without understanding the business side of the film industry, without understanding distribution. If not, they will take advantage of you. They will steal money from you, and you will not make another movie. Mongo Wilder.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, guys, today on the show, we have filmmaker Jeff Santo, who has a unique story that I've never heard of before, that he got screwed by a distributor on his first film out. I'd never heard anything like that before. I was shocked and had to have him come on the show and tell us all about it. No, I'm joking, but it is true. He did get screwed by the first distributor he worked with back in the day with his first movie, and he vowed to never, ever work with a distributor again. And he started to self-distribute his films. And he had found real success with niche filmmaking, meaning that he understood his niche market, targeted that market, and sold his movie to that audience. But how he's done it, though, is he's made really big strides in self-distributing DVDs to his audience. We're talking about tens of thousands of DVDs, over hundreds of thousands over the course of his career. And he continues to do it today. And we're going to get into the weeds about how he was able to do it, how he identifies his niche audience, how he markets to that niche audience, and how he sells his DVDs, as well as other revenue streams from his film. He is definitely walking down the filmtrepreneur path. If I may take something from The Mandalorian, this is the way. Without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jeff Santo. I'd like to welcome to the show Jeff Santo, man. Thank you so much for being on the show, brother.
Absolutely, Alex. Good to be here.
So, you know, you reached out to me a little while ago and told me all about how you've basically become you were one of the originating filmtrepreneurs in many, many ways back in the day. And we're going to get into all of that. But before we do that, man, how did you get into business in the first place?
Wow, it goes way back. I helped John Cusack. I was a technical director for John Cusack in Eight Men Out.
Wow. That's awesome.
he played the part of Buck Weaver, the third baseman for the Black Sox, and which was a John Sayles film. Talk about one of the great independent filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Guys have been off the grid and been very successful. Mm-hmm. So, he didn't know how to play baseball at the time. So I helped him out, trained him. My dad came in a few times, too, to help out. I don't know if you know much about my father, who played professional baseball.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, he played for the Cubs. He's a Hall of Famer for the Chicago Cubs.
That's amazing.
So That's how it started. He got me a bit part in a movie, and you know, I just fell in love with. I was always a movie buff, and I was kind of in transition, just got out of college, and I fell in love with the craft, and I just started really studying on my own of how to write a screenplay, and went from there. And next thing you know, I got hooked up with Joe Mantegna. I did a couple of plays, a play in Chicago, a play in Arizona, and Joe Mantegna liked my play and said, come out to LA. We'll do a reading of it at the Cannon Theater, on Cannon Boulevard in Beverly Hills. And it kind of started from there.
That's not a bad way to come to LA, my friend.
Yeah.
That's the way it happens for everybody, I think, isn't it? I
mean, everyone. Yeah. you don't know how it's going to start. And there is no one set path, as you have talked about.
No, there's no question about it. And there's so many people who try to, like, well, this is, you know, I'm going to do it the way Robert Rodriguez did, or I'm going to do it the way Kevin Smith did, or I'm going to do it the way Oren Peli did it, or any of these, or John Sayles. Like, there is no one way. There's, oh, you know, a lot of times these paths that open up, they open up for a short period of time, and then they close right behind them. So, like, there's periods of time that is available to filmmakers. And like for me, I couldn't do what I did 11 years ago when I showed up here in LA. Right. I mean, I showed up with a Final Cut system, and I said, hey, I'm going to edit. And I was able to do it. If I showed up today with that same system, I would die.
Exactly. You know, and you just don't know where you're going to go. I mean, if you have a passion for it and you're dedicated, you know, once I came to LA, I think once you come to LA, you're kind of in now. You know what I mean? It's like people come out and they don't like LA and it's over. But, you know, the ones that really want it stay here and they weather through it. And you have to. You know, and back when I started, you know, I came out to LA in 94. And, you know, we were still in the film process. So making a film was difficult.
Oh.
The steps were a lot, I would say, they're more difficult to climb. There were fewer steps. Now there's many steps. You know, that you got to climb a lot more. You have a lot more access and resources to getting a camera and shooting your movie. But back then with film, you know, you talked about being a projectionist. I mean, you know, I remember color timing my first film at IFC, you know? And I remember one of my assistants on the film, right before I was doing the color timing, she found Quentin Tarantino's driver's license in her seat. So he was just color timing Jackie Brown at the time, which I was like, ah, that's pretty cool. You know, but, you know, and then you carry around those canisters of film, which we had, and, you know, went to a few film festivals and then found out how difficult it was in distribution from that point on.
So, yeah, tell me about your first distribution experience.
Yeah, well, I did a film called Liar's Poker in 98. And I went to the film, I went to Palm Springs and did very well there. And that's before Palm Springs blew up now. I mean, that's one of the top film festivals now. So, you know, I had a lot of distributors come at me. I even had, you know, back then, I don't know today, as far as, you know, those producer reps that come on and you got to get a nice producer rep to rep your film and put you out there. So finding those guys, you know, that's another swamp that you got to go into. And they lump you with other films, but we had a lot of offers foreign on the foreign side. And I remember our investor said, no, we're not going to take this one that was healthy at the time. It was like $350,000 for foreign. And they threw it down. I'm like, guys,
what was the budget, by the way? What was the budget of your film?
It was about $1 million.
Okay.
Yeah, $1 million. Yeah. Now I say no one should go out and do a $1 million film on their first film unless you're really tied into the system. You just should not do that. You won't get it back. But, so I wound up taking another foreign deal after we passed on that, and I put it in the theaters. I kind of four-walled it, and I was fortunate to get a Blockbuster deal at the time.
What is this Blockbuster you speak of, sir?
Well, Blockbuster – yeah, right? But Blockbuster at the time, remember they were taking on independent film?
Oh, yeah. I remember.
And Boondock Saints did really well in Blockbuster. Oh. They were like the first one they took on. And so I had a connection to the Boondock Saints crew and they turned me on to Blockbuster. And so, you know, at one time I had 20 cassettes in Blockbuster on Liar's Poker. So it made some money back, but we still got killed. Sure. And you know, for a filmmaker, I always say this now. I say, you know, the one thing you don't want to owe money. You don't want to, you know, that's the worst burden to feel in making a film, is that you didn't pay back your investors. So that stuck with me a long time. And so when I made my second film, I made sure, and my second film was a documentary I did on my father. Mm-hmm. He was the first Major League Baseball player to play with type 1 diabetes back in the, you know, the early 60s. And he lost his legs later in his life to diabetes. And so I did that story on him when he lost his second leg, and I flashed back into his career. And I was fortunate to get Ira Deutschman, who was from Emerging Pictures, to get involved with me in putting the film out there. And Ira was the co-founder of Fine Line Pictures back in the day, mm-hmm. which was the art house entity to New Line Cinema.
Right.
So I told Ira, I got screwed on my first film. I want this to go into theaters. I don't want it just to go to video and be just a baseball film, you know, just like a typical Cub film, because the Cubs had a big audience across the nation. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure it came out as a film because, you know, we put a lot of work into it. And I told him that I want to get in the theaters first and then we'll go from there. So Ira, we were the first to go into a theatrical distribution deal that digitally projected our film. So Ira actually bought the digital projectors into the theater back in 2004. Okay. And so we went into like five different theaters in Chicago and did very well. And then we even went out into like Indiana, the Cub market, really. We went into Indiana, Wisconsin, and I traveled around that little, you know, the about five states that circled Illinois. Mm-hmm. And we did very well just on word of mouth. And this is before Facebook and all that social media. Mm-hmm. And I had a website, so I was constantly communicating with my audience through our website, doing Q&As. And my father was a broadcaster on WGN Radio for the Cubs at the time, so I would go on there a lot. And we were really tapped into the market. And we even wound up staying in a theater in St. Charles, Illinois for 6 months.
Wow.
And it was great because the theater would have an organ in it, so we made it an event. Had an organ that did take me out to the ball game before the movie started. And we also put a jar out in the lobby, said if anyone wanted to donate to Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, because my dad's been a diabetic. Wow, he got it in 58 for 30 years. And so the theater wound up raising $10,000 for the foundation just for my film. So that was kind of the feeling that we had on this film. And we did it all on our own. So it was self-distributed, working as a partnership with Ira Deutschman and his company called Emerging Pictures. Mm-hmm. So I was involved in every aspect of distributing the film. So when it came to releasing the DVD, we had offers from New Line Cinema, a bunch of different places. But the offers were typical. You know, they're just going to take everything and we're not going to see, you know, a majority of the profits. So I told Ira, I've really built up a lot of following on our website. Let's just make the DVD, put it out ourselves, and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And we did that. And we wound up making the DVDs for like $1, you mm-hmm. know, and packaged in the little box and had a nice poster cover, everything. And we wound up selling 40,000 DVDs on our website for $24.99 a
That's
box.
Amazing.
Yeah. And we wound up selling merchandise. And so it just became this thing that, you know, just kept on growing, and people knew that when they were buying the film too, they were also, a portion was going to JDR off the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. So it just became this thing that we were controlling on our own, where, you know, the profits came to us from our hard work, and also a portion went to JDRF. We wound up like raising over $500,000 for JDRF. We even had a guy, this is funny, that called my father and said, hey, listen, I saw the film 7 times and I was so inspired that I'm going to walk from Arizona to Wrigley Field and honor your father and the movie. And I said, well, maybe we can help you out. So we wound up staging all these spots for him to get support. And it took him like 6 months to make the walk. And Wrigley Field, the Cubs got behind us. Even the governor, remember at the time, Governor Blagojevich was a big Cub fan who wound up getting in a lot of trouble soon after. But he walked with our guy the last, like, block. And then my dad met this guy. The guy came through the right field wall of Wrigley Field and met my father on the mound to a standing ovation at Wrigley Field. So those are the things that we did for marketing of the film. And it just went from there, and it's still selling. You know,
So I want to get this straight. So everybody listening understands what's going on. You created a product, you controlled the distribution of the product, and you marketed it to a niche audience and basically created a little mini business out of that one film alone.
Yes.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Isn't that a shocking way of doing business in the film industry? Like, the thing that kills me is that the story that you just laid out, mm-hmm, is an outlier.
Yeah.
It is not the way business is done. And that's what I'm trying to change. And you obviously picked that up early on. And around the same time is when I did my first film in 2005, where I sold a bunch of DVDs directly to my audience. I knew who my audience was and basically started the whole filmtrepreneur method and model that I've kind of developed over the years. It started at that point. But you were doing a version of that without question. But the thing is this, is that – well, before I want to go a little deeper into that. But when you said you got screwed on the first movie, what exactly happened? So, you know, did the distributor not pay you? Did they screw you? How was it specifically, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah. Well, Blockbuster was decent with us. Mm-hmm. And then we went with the distributor after that, and we hardly saw anything. And the foreign distributor, I mean, what they gave us paid for catering. It was awful. And mm-hmm, it was such a burden for me that I even went into the hospital I had atrial fibrillation in my heart.
Oh, Jesus.
And I was young, and they couldn't even say, how did you get this? You know, and I said, listen, I don't do drugs. You know, I drink beer once in a while, but this is because of stress. So I was so upset from that I said, my next film, I'm not going down these lanes, and especially the film that's on my father. I'm going to make sure that I control every aspect of distributing this, where the funds come to us, because mm-hmm, just can't trust distributors. And at the time, you know, I say this about the traditional method of distributing. You know, these indie distributors, and if you don't get picked up by, you know, a major studio, you are now aligned with these independent distributors. Mm-hmm. And their whole purpose, you know, first of all, their whole purpose is to grab a bunch of films.
Yep.
And see how much they can make from each one, and then they're done. They'll exploit the hell out of them. Mm-hmm. And then you're left with hardly anything. I mean, literally nothing. Mm-hmm. And they don't care, because they think that they're doing you a service by putting your film out there. Right. And they don't understand that this is a person's career, because if you're not picked up by a studio, you know, filmmakers think, oh, well, if it's out there wherever, I'm going to get noticed. No, Hollywood's not like that. They don't have scouts like in baseball that go out and say, hey, man, this guy did a good film. And at the time, too, I even put This Old Cub, that's the title of my documentary, into mm-hmm, Sundance. And Sundance rejected it. And I remember when I was distributing it with Ira, he said, I just got back from Sundance. And he knew all the guys at Sundance, because he worked closely with them when he ran mm-hmm, Fine Line. And he said, they wanted to know why you didn't put This Old Cub in there. Because I told him what's going on. I have this film with you. And I said, I did. And it just goes to show you that it could be some person,
yep,
who watched it for 5 minutes, has no idea, might not even be a baseball fan. It's not really about baseball. It's about a man, mm-hmm, and his spirit and overcoming adversity and everything like that. But you just don't know. It's all subjective to who's going to look at your film, mm-hmm, to pass it on to the next level. And that's how it went. And so I said, hey, Ira, it doesn't matter. We're doing this now. And it wound up, when we released it in the theaters, in five theaters, our screen gross, per screen gross, was number 5 on IndieWire, twice.
Wow.
So a documentary. You know, my documentary in the theaters made over $250,000 in the theaters, and I made that documentary for $300,000. Mm-hmm. So I was already close to being positive, you know, with a couple of expenses in that. And so once the DVD came, we were ready to rock and roll. We had some money to finance our DVD product and go from there.
And how about – and you sold a ton of merch as well.
Oh, yeah. A ton of merch. This will come merch and jackets, shirts. It was
Autograph. I'm assuming autographs because of your dad.
Yes. Yep. Autographed DVDs. And I learned that through really Boondock Saints, to tell you the truth, because Boondock Saints, that story is a horrific one that he went through. I mean, that movie wound up making over $200 million after its blockbuster release, and they saw absolutely almost nothing, the filmmakers. And I know there's a big story behind Troy Duffy and everything that went on with the documentary they made on him. And we all know about that, and I knew Troy. And I look at that, and that was kind of unfair because I'm like, okay, yeah, Troy went a little off, but he's a passionate filmmaker trying to get his film out there. He's young.
Yep.
And when these guys, you know, he gave permission for these guys to do the documentary on him. But at the same time, it's like, wait a second, you're making Harvey Weinstein the hero here. It's David and Goliath.
Yeah, it doesn't age well.
It doesn't do well. Yeah, there's nothing. It's like, wait, I'm rooting for the studio here. You know, I don't care what the guy does. You just look at that whole picture and you go, wait a second, man. You know, he was the first to tell Harvey to F off, you know, and look where Harvey is now. It's just, but that's the system. You can't really give the finger to the 800-pound gorilla. The system is the system for a reason. You know, you just want to be treated fairly at some point if you have a decent film.
Yeah, and no question about it. And for everybody who doesn't know the story behind Boondock Saints, I mean, a lot of people from our generation definitely knows, but if anybody wants to watch that documentary, it's called Overnight. And it, you know, over the years after I've watched it many times, I am a fan of it, and it is a cautionary tale. And a lot of the things that Troy said in the movie, he obviously did, but it was edited and it was, the story was molded and to go a certain direction. And you're right. They've made the studio the hero and him the villain. With that said, Troy did give him a lot of ammunition.
There's no doubt about that.
A lot of ammunition to it. So, yeah. but the point is that you're right. He was young, man. He was thrown into, I mean, I look at it now as an older filmmaker and I look at that movie and I'm like, dude, the guy was a kid. He had no idea what he was walking into. He was literally thrown into the deep, deep, deep end of the pool. This is Harvey at the height of his power.
Yep.
In the mid 90s when literally he was the Hollywood god, basically coming down from Mount Hollywood, and anyone he touched turned to gold. And it was just a very unique 5-year, 8-year period in his career, in Harvey's career. And this kid comes in. You could tell that Troy, you know, Troy's from the street. He's a hustler. And, you know, he's ex-bartender, and was it Boston? Where was he from?
Boston, yeah.
Yeah, he was from Boston. So he's not going to take any crap from some Hollywood, you know, a-hole. And he didn't understand the politics. He didn't understand the game. He didn't understand what was going on. And it was a very dangerous mix. I had a very short version of that in my early career, but I had a gangster who was literally on top of me the entire time. So my ego didn't get a chance to really get out of hand.
Right. I understand that.
You know, honestly, because if I would have been thrown in Troy's situation at the age that he was at when he did it, I don't think I would have gone as far as he did, but I know I would have destroyed myself. There's just no question.
Yeah. I think you're right, man. And I look at that too. I got to know Troy really well. I mean, we became friends and I got to know him there's a friend at New Line Cinema that we both had a mutual friendship with. And he said, hey, listen, man, there's this film, because he liked Liar's Poker. Mm-hmm. And he said, you got to check out this film, Boondock Saints. It's playing at Technicolor, screening for some of the execs. Why don't you go over there and watch it? I went over there and watched it. I'm like, wow, this is an independent film. This kid did this, you know? And I'm like, I was impressed. You know, I'm like, this is unbelievable. I haven't really talked to many guys that are doing what I'm doing, because at the time it was difficult to make a movie, you know? So I was like, I'd like to meet him. And so we met and we hit it off, because I think I was the first filmmaker that put myself out there too with a film that he could talk to. And so we got along in a different way. And it was post all the drama he went through with Harvey. It was already put aside. So
yeah, and from my understanding, he had a lot more control over the sequel, and he made money on the sequel, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, and he did with Sony. And I always told him with the sequel, I said, man, you should do this your own, because Troy, what happened was, him and his producing partner and their wives mm-hmm. opened up a website and said, hey, listen, we're not making any money off our movie and it's doing great. Let's sell the merchandise because we own the merchandise. It's the only thing they didn't have in the contract. Mm-hmm. He goes, let's start selling the merchandise. So they put up like just this image of a T-shirt without even making their first T-shirt and just got all these orders. And mm-hmm. next thing you know, they rolled it into a Hot Topic deal with Hot Topic at the time that was really big, and they just blew it out. I mean, it was like, wow. They now had money coming in, and they were starting to be able to live. And
off of merch.
Only. Almost kind of like what the Rock and Rollers are doing today.
You know?
They don't make their money on really their mm-mm. events. They make it on selling the merch at the events. That's how it's coming. So when he did that, I said, okay, my film with This Old Cub, I'm going the same route, but I'm going to do the DVDs too. So I said, just imagine, Troy, if you had your DVDs, how much money he would have made if he owned the movie himself. So I always said, do the second one on your own, but he wanted to get tied in the system, and he went that way, and he still did very well. But it's sad. It's sad how it turned out, but I'm glad how he got through it all. Mm-hmm. And then yet the guys that made the film on him, they were friends to start out with, and you know how that goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone – out here, it gets ugly, and you look back, and it shouldn't have went that way. But I always said, I always maintained that, you know, that film didn't do anything for indie filmmakers because I wanted to see the other side. Like, it's, you know, you don't know what's happening with the big guys that are coming on top of you and telling you what to do and where to go and how to do this. And so that was the only disappointment on it all. But I learned so much from what he did by just starting his website of how I can do it now from a fresh start of starting my film this way.
So you sold 40,000, and the thing that was which is brilliant about your story is that you had a resource, and I preach about this constantly, is you checked out what you had available to you, and you wanted to tell a story about the things you had available to you, which are obviously your father, and you wanted to tell a story about your father, but then you also had a connection to the Cubs organization, the Chicago Cub organization, Wrigley yep. Field, communities, and you're like, wait a minute, I can leverage these relationships and build and tap into an audience that wants this product. And you did that wholeheartedly, coming from a really good place, even giving to charity off of it. Mm-hmm. And that's another great thing that you were able to do is you were able to partner with an organization to help that organization that brings more attention to your product. It positions you better in the marketplace, even though I know it wasn't about that, but it does help as Absolutely. Well. And at the end of the day, you were able to, you know, where do you think you made the most revenue from that film? Was it from the theater? Was it from the DVDs, or was it from the merch?
DVD 100%.
DVD.
100% DVD. But what the theater did, it gave me exposure that this was a real movie.
Correct. You know what I
mean? So that made the DVD sell. And so when we were doing so well on our website, I said, well, how can I get into the retail end of it? And so mm-hmm. what I did is I made a deal with Walgreens, personal deal with Walgreens in Chicago. So it was right around the holidays that Walgreens put us in, I think, 600 stores. And we made our own like display case, sent packaged with 12 DVDs in them and to all these Walgreens, and then kept on filling them up. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't keep them in. And so I also made another deal with Cub Foods, which was kind of a grocery store outlet in Chicago, in the Illinois area. Mm-hmm. And that was gangbusters. So we did very well with that part of it too. And we wound up selling at the end of the day about 80,000 DVDs.
So you sell 40,000 DVDs through your website, and then mm-hmm. wholesaling it out, making these deals with other chains, you were able to distribute your film through them and sold another 40,000.
Exactly. And the wholesale price was around $11, $11, $12.
And it cost you about a dollar to make.
Even in that retail business, we were making 10 bucks each pop off the DVD.
Jesus, man. And mm-hmm. It was arguably regional. So, you know, I talk about the regional cinema model, and this is a version of that because not everyone – this is not a movie for everybody. This is mm-hmm. a movie for people who love the Cubs and a little bit maybe of a spill-off, anyone who's interested in baseball, you know, so baseball documentaries. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. But there's so much competition with baseball documentaries that it's hard to get noticed. But if because it, you were focusing on people who are interested in the Cubs and baseball, you were able to penetrate that audience fairly easily and then also kept it regional. So you weren't just selling it on your website. You were also going out and doing your theatrical and making these deals for regional releases of your film all on your own in a time where that wasn't really done. And it's still not done as much as what you're talking about. That's really very much filmtrepreneurial spirit, yeah. Sir.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And it all stemmed from getting burned on my first film. So,
and it was painful. And I'm sure that was painful.
It was very painful. And it's still painful when I think about it. But with this old Cub, yeah, it was to a point where the word of mouth just worked on it, you know. And back then too, documentaries weren't exploding
right
out there. You know, mm-hmm. you're still it's 2004 and then mm-hmm. but the big documentary that also helped me in the making of it was The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Great film.
Yeah, beautiful film. And they were doing a lot of different things there with Photoshop. So we mm-hmm. were like second documentary because we came right around the corner of that picture. And so I did a lot of Photoshop stuff where, you know, Major League Baseball, if you use any footage from Major League Baseball, they charge you $7,000 a minute. Mm-hmm. So I used a lot of photos for my dad that I wouldn't have. I used probably like 7 minutes of total game footage. Mm-hmm. So it was really, you know, I was able to follow my dad around. Like you said, the Cubs helped out. They gave us access to Wrigley Field. They let me travel with my father. You know, at the time he had two prosthetic legs and was announcing for the Cubs, so I would follow him. And so he had like two careers. He had the baseball career, and then he became the broadcaster and the big fan in the broadcast booth that everyone loved. As a player, he was this hard-nosed guy, and in the booth, he was this lovable fan. So that added to our film. And plus, our film did have a universal take on it, meaning it wasn't just baseball. If, yes, you're a baseball fan, you're going to love it more. And my whole thing about that was, you know, I want to make sure that the Cub fans are like, hey, they're going to call me out if there's some things in here don't jive. So I got to get that right. But I really was making the film for someone that wasn't a baseball fan that could just take the journey with this man, you know. So you got to look also in making a film like, okay, yeah, you got your market. But hey, make it universal because it can bleed out into others. And right now it's, you know, it's on iTunes and still doing okay, you know?
Yeah, because you have a niche, built-in niche audience. And that yes. It's evergreen. It's an evergreen product. It is something that will live on for many years to come. I'm assuming you still make revenue with it every year, correct?
We make a little, you know, but it's nice that it's still out there. Like someone can access it. Right now, I'm just glad people can access my dad's father, whether I'm making money on it or not, you know?
Right, of course.
It's about can they access the story.
So. Right. Exactly. But, you know, you made obviously in the life cycle of a film, you're going to make most of your money up front. But if you could still generate revenue, and I'm sure if you actually started to pump in some energy to it, it might actually make more money in today's world. But you're good. You know, you just want to get it out there. And you've been able to generate as much revenue as you can. But, you know, you did phenomenally with it, man. Yeah. That's an amazing story. Now, did you – you built your audience, or at least you cultivated that audience, leveraging the relationship with the Cubs and the access that your dad had with that fan base, correct?
Exactly, 100%.
And then also, did you collect emails during like theatrical screenings or anything like that to like be able to direct market?
Yeah, we had so many emails that we responded to. So many people wrote into us. Yeah, we were on top of that every day. I mean, we had an office right on Ventura Boulevard where we did all the packing, shipping, everything. So every day we were at that office just busting out DVDs, answering emails, answering anything if the DVD was scratched or whatever. We were a great customer company too at the time. You know, you have to be. So, and it was my dad, so I was going to make sure that everything went the right way.
Yeah, this was an emotional – this is not just a business opportunity. This was an emotional and artistic expression of what you wanted to do and honor your father. So it has a different vibe than just, you know, I just created a widget. But at the end of the day though, you're still able to create art, but you were able to generate revenue from that art and able to do a lot of good with that film, like being able to raise all the money you did for that, for the charity, as well as generate revenue for yourself and your family and your father.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, at the time too, I remember, you know, you've heard of Peter Broderick, right?
Of course. I just had him on the show.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Well, Peter Broderick had a, at the time I did this, he knew Ira Deutschman, and Ira got me on one of his panels. I think it was around 2005. And I was up there with the writer-director of Blair Witch, who also got
Eduardo?
I forgot the, who it was, the guy's name.
It was one of the two. It was Eduardo or the other guy, I forgot.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we were up there talking about our films, and, you know, it was sad to see what he went through, too.
Oh.
That made so much money. But my model really inspired a lot of filmmakers that were at this event. I think I was – and Peter even used my model throughout for a while, because I think I was one of the first to do it, to say, okay, we're going to go out there. We're going to control the theatrical distribution, and then we're going to control the selling of the DVD market. 100%. I didn't give it up to, and until that kind of ran out, then I said, okay, Ira brought us another distributor that we can go and give it off to and see if they can go out there farther with. And we did, and that still didn't turn out great. You know what I mean? So
anytime you deal, generally speaking, and I'm not going to say everyone, but generally speaking, when you deal with a distributor, their interest is not to generate revenue for you. Their interest is to make as much money as they can from exploiting the film and putting that money in their pockets. That's the business model. Am I wrong?
Yeah, about the distributors, that they don't care about making money for the filmmakers. The system that they have, and the way I look at this is, you know, you talk about the old traditional model. The model was always bad for filmmakers. There was never a good model there. You know, if you think going back to the days of Scorsese and Coppola and all those guys were true independent filmmakers. That their model was the studio. So it really didn't start coming around until, like you were talking about, Sex, Lies, and Videotape is when the independent market started really coming to life. Although I think Michael Mann's Thief was amazing. That's kind of what got me into filmmaking. But the model was it's even if you look at it, they don't even take on the pension and health part of these union films. So they go and exploit your film, but they're not even responsible for paying pension and wealth. So you wind up having the guilds come after your LLC.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about that, because I heard about the issue you had with the DGA. What was exactly what happened? And for everyone listening, the DGA is the Directors Guild of America. So what happened there?
Yeah, on this film I did, Jake's Corner, which I went back to the old traditional model because I couldn't find a niche there. I thought I had a niche, but I didn't, is that once it's out there and they exploit it, the DGA tracks how it's doing, all the guilds do, and say, okay, you owe this, they owe this much money for the director, who I was the director at the time, that forfeited my DGA union fees to just do the movie. And so they're actually calling me and saying, you know, we got you this money, that we know that you're owed this, but we're coming after the company that did it. I said, well, I'm part of the company. You know, you're going to try and get money from them to pay me. They paid for my movie. You can't do that, you know? And so they do that with everything. So it's the Actors Guild too, and the Writers Guild. So all that comes after you to pay these fees when you're not getting any of the revenue. It's all going to the distributor. So the distributor gets the flow of the money. They should be responsible for paying the unions, because they're holding the money, but they're not responsible. None of these distributors are. And that's where they get away with it. They're not responsible for it. So you're going to get hit again by your film doing well out there, but you're not seeing any of the dollars, and the unions are going to come after you, your LLC, who was responsible for making the movie.
And that's only if you are – if you use people – So perfect example is a film that a friend of ours of the show, Michael Polish and Mark Polish, who did a movie called For Lovers Only. They were one of the first digital DSLR films ever, and they made $500,000 selling this no budget independent film on iTunes. And he's a DGA, he was a DGA member, and the star was a SAG member, but they didn't sign a deal with SAG. So, and they weren't going to punish the star because she was a big TV star at the time, and they're not going to go after her. So, well, there you go. SAG basically had no power. But the DGA gave him nothing but hell because these unions, which are on one hand are really great, but on the other hand are built on the old system. They're built on the studio system. That's why it took so long for SAG and now the DGA to even think about independent, low-budget, micro-budget filmmaking. They were stuck. They're stuck in the studio system because those guilds run on the studio system. Without the studio system and the deal that they've made with the studio systems, they don't function. So the independents are, you know, they try to treat independents like the studios, and that's just not going to work. Perfect example, your situation.
Yes, and that's why I did so well with the documentary, because that's not union. And correct. Then, and like your buddy you just talked about, that was smart. Now, the actor might get some flack, but they laid off because who's – I look at this too. It's like an actor to cross over and do a non-union film. It's like, well, is the union getting you work? If they're not, then you got to do it. You got to work, man. So that I always say you should not do a union film because you're going to get hit twice. You're not going to receive the money and the revenue, and then you're going to get hit by the unions. So you, the films that I succeeded on were both non-union films.
Without question. And again, it's all about – and there are – like with SAG, there are definitely micro-budget ways of going about it. Especially if you're doing very low budget films. So you can't work with SAG. DGA, you generally don't have to worry about on a $250,000 below film, generally speaking. It does happen. And those are the only two. I mean, the Writers Guild as well, you have to worry about if you bring in a WGA. But generally at that budget range, you're still not dealing with those kind of people. So It is a concern, definitely. And you, as a DGA member, which is fascinating that you're a member and they're screwing you.
They don't understand. So they're sending me letters. I'm part of the company that made the film, so you're actually coming after me. I'm the director, part of this company that got the financial backing of it. And, you know, we haven't seen any dollars, so you can't ask this company to pay me more money. It's just not fair. That's who I am. I'm like, I can't take this money. So I had to go sit down and say, I'm not going to take the money. I'm just not, you know, because we haven't seen anything. These guys put a lot of money out and, you know, it's been a big burden and you're asking them to put more money out to pay me. You know, right. It doesn't make any sense. And so there should. Yeah. And you're right about that. It's, you know, it's one of these things where these distributors, and that's why, like, now the distributors, the only reason that we're starting to hear more about how tough it is today is because the distributors are hurting now because they can't make. You know, it should have went back to when the filmmakers can't make money, you know, and I believe there should be a whole new system. I always talked about that. There should be some kind of system that needs some power behind it where, you know, because everyone starts out with a great idea until it gets corrupted. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's like the idea has to be filmmakers that has some power behind them where they can control their films, you know, because not every film is going to get bought by a studio at Sundance. Those are lottery picks, a lot of those. You know, you want to go for that.
And that still doesn't guarantee anything nowadays.
It doesn't. And even back when, you know, yeah, the low budget SAGs, the ultra low budget, if you make a really great film and get picked up by a studio, well, that's the way to go. But that is a lottery ticket. And so if you have to be smarter than that to change the system. And you have to really put the work in to say, where's my market? And if there could be a system that could work with filmmakers and have a system just for the indie film, the off-the-grid indie film. I'm not talking about these companies that say they're independent when they're working with stars and they're really connected to the studio. I'm talking about the off-the-grid that you and I have done, you know, because there's a lot of money out there. And obviously, you know, it was a $3 billion business at one time. And where did that money go? You know, well, it went to a lot of distributors, but it didn't go to a lot of filmmakers. And now they're not even seeing that money anymore because the system was always broken. Well, now it's like, can you, if someone could come up with where can generate that could take care of some of these, I wouldn't call them B films, they're independent films that might be missing here and there, but they still have a market, you know, then you might find something. But I've always preached that, and I don't know what that is. I tried it at one time, and I'm just like, it's hard to duplicate our model. Every film's different, but, you know, it's for the films that don't have a niche market that they could be lumped in with the other indies that people could come and look at. But today there's so much content that I don't know how you can get it done.
I think the greatest power and the greatest tool that a filmmaker, independent filmmaker, has today is the niche. It cuts through all of the noise. Like perfect example, your film, This Gold Cub. If I'm scanning through Netflix or Prime or wherever I'm watching my stuff and I see your film, if I'm a Cubs fan, that jumps to the top of my priority list of watching or consuming content. It cuts through all the other stuff that the studios are pumping billions of dollars to get in front of my eyeballs. That film will cut through all of it because of it. It is something that interests me. So the power of the niche is – honestly, I feel the only thing that will help a filmmaker survive in this new film economy that we are in and get walking into. It's getting harder and harder and harder. And I don't know if you heard my episode where I said the death of traditional film distribution.
Yes.
I mean, it was so sad to watch at AFM where I was walking around talking to distributors. They have no idea how to make money anymore. Because the old structure, the old system is breaking down around them. Every month that goes by, there's a new thing that knocks that system down a little bit. And it's getting worse and worse. It's getting harder and harder. So they're becoming more and more predatory. They're holding onto the money even more. They're literally cooking books. There's so many things that are being done because they're getting desperate. And if they think this desperate now, I said it there and I'll say it again. Wait till we hit the next financial, you know, disturbance in the force, you know, when we have the next downturn, which we're due, we're overdue. So when that happens, I honestly think that the whole system's going to come crashing down in this, the old system is going to come crashing down and hopefully something new will come out of the rubble, but it's not going to be what it is. And again, this happened with publishing and it happened in the music industry.
Exactly. And again, going back to the old traditional way of distributing, I still think, you know, you don't want to be in that. You might have got an advance, you know, a small advance, and now they're not giving any advances. No. But, you know, they were always cooking the books, man. You know, there's a few good ones out there probably. I can't put everyone down, but I didn't find any, you know. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, it's just unfair. It's unfair because they don't work with the unions. They're on their own. They know that these filmmakers, some of them have bigger budgets than others, and they're never going to see a dime. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, you know, their intentions are to really work with the filmmaker and care No. about what they have to get back in return. So that system to me, once I got burned, and I got burned again, which was my fault because I didn't have a niche mark with the film. But then I did a film after that, which was not a documentary, that dealt with the motorcycle club culture. Mm-hmm. And I did the same thing as This Old Cub, and I succeeded again. And this was in 2013 with DVDs, and I sold over 30,000 DVDs into the motorcycle club culture, you know, and said, it can work. You got a niche. It can work. But DVDs are starting to fade now, and now you're dealing with streaming. And I'm on the streaming sites, but I waited to do streaming until my DVD kind of trickled out. Mm-hmm. So, but you're not going to make much on these streaming sites. And, you know, you're talking about people renting it for, you know, $3.99 and buying it for $9.99.
If you're lucky that they'll buy it or rent it, they don't do that anymore.
Right. And, you know, so you're talking about, you're competing with all the big films on these streaming sites. So someone to find your film, like you just talked about, has to be a niche. So my film did well because this is a niche in the motorcycle culture. So unless you have a niche, you should not be making an independent film. But I'm not saying don't make it. It's just know that you got to keep your costs down and you got to make something really special and very original. And that takes time and that takes experience.
Yeah, no question. And so if we took what you did with This Old Cub, because I know a lot of people listening, because filmmakers are the most cynical crowd in the world, without question, they're going to go, well, you know, it was 2004 and DVDs, you can make money with DVDs back then. Even 2013, you can make money with DVDs. You can't do that now. So like if we took This Old Cub and released it today, if This Old Cub would have never been released originally, and you still had access, you still had all the access to the audience that you could, What do you think would happen in today's world? Do you think you would be able to generate a good amount of revenue from TVOD, which, you know, with his rentals and purchases on digital platforms? But would you make more money from appearances with your father? Would you make more money with the merch? Would you make more money with theatrical, making events out of it? How would you change that model a little bit in today's world?
Okay. Yeah, that's a loaded question. With my father's documentary, I might go directly to like a Netflix with it because it had that much weight. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that they might have worked with me in doing it.
Okay.
So that's one avenue.
That's one revenue stream.
Yep. I would probably say I want to own the DVD part of it.
Sure. But they're still going to sell some DVDs even today.
Yeah. Yeah. They are, because a niche, you know, people still have their DVD players and they want to own something, and especially if you make it a collectible.
But so, and also the other thing too, I just want to, I don't mean to interrupt you. The one other thing too is, who is the audience? So is the audience for your documentary about your father an older audience? Then DVD is still a viable option because a lot of that audience still consumes DVD. Redbox is still a thing. People still rent. So it depends on the generation. And on the generation that you're of your audience, because they will, a lot of people will still buy DVD. Like my mom and my father, they have no understanding. Like streaming is magical to them. You know, it's like magic. Like what do you mean the internet? Like they don't get it. But you give them a DVD, they're like, I understand what this is. So there's still, for this kind of product, if I was consulting you on this scenario, I would say no, DVD is still very viable because of the audience you're targeting. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. I'm with you 100% on that too. And mm-hmm. The thing is though, will it hit as many people if you get it on Netflix? Some or an Amazon Prime, one of the big players that actually mm-hmm. work with you. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I do feel that particular project, this old Cub, would have got a meeting at those companies.
Yeah.
And so I'm just saying, for exposure wise, your film getting out wider, it'd be great to have on Netflix as a release, or an Amazon or a Hulu. You know, so I look at that and go, okay, I'm playing between both. Do I want to really hit the pavement real hard? No, I got to work so hard, just get eyeballs on this. But I do agree that the older crowd will buy those DVDs. And I did that with my Motorcycle Club film that came out in 2013. The mm-hmm. DVD was still alive. But I did a different DVD this time. I did mm-hmm. a two-disc DVD. I did a making of, because we shot in real motorcycle clubs. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to show that. And so I did a 16-page booklet. So I made this a really fancy DVD, a little more expensive, like $250. $275, but then I sold it for $30 to start with, right to my culture. And it mm-hmm. went. Mm-hmm. And it went. And so, and it's still going. I mean, 7 years later, it's sold in every foreign country mm-hmm. from us. Mm-hmm. So we're selling it. I mean, literally, we sent DVDs out to, I think, a lot of them. Believe me, a lot of them.
And also, don't forget, and a thing also everybody in the audience should understand too, is DVD is still a thing overseas. You know, streaming is not taking over the world completely. A lot of other markets in Europe, in Asia, in South America, DVD is still the way people consume media. So there's still – DVD is not dead by any stretch of the imagination.
It's not dead at all. I mean, I'm still getting DVD screeners from the DGA and WGA, you know. So they send out those screeners. You know, everyone has a DVD. So it's like, right. You know. But like you said,
by the way, and I need to borrow those DVDs. I'm just asking. I'm joking.
You got it. Come on over.
Anytime. Yeah. So, go ahead.
So I do think like it's an older audience that does watch the DVDs, and it's still out there. That's eventually going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that, you know, your concept of making it for the least amount of money as possible, that's the first thing you have to do. A lot of these young filmmakers think go big, you know, no, don't go big. Do not go big. And they get a lot of advice from people that aren't in the business, which don't take advice from people who aren't in the business. Take advice
who haven't walked it, who haven't walked the. Yeah. I love people that take advice from people who've never done it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that, like, there's two topics. There's people like, you know, there's coaches who are like screenwriting coaches and they're teachers and they're academics, and they have a lot of value, no question about it. But when you're talking to a filmmaker about filmmaking and selling their movie, and they've never made a movie, does that make sense? If you're just an executive that, you know, like, and not even an executive. Some of these guys that are out there selling products and they've never done it. It fascinates me. It just, and it pisses me off too.
Me too, man. And Alex, like you were saying, man, there's friends I have in the business that are doing well that have never gone through what I went through. So they have no idea. You know what I mean? They're making studio deals. They don't know the other side, the off the grid side, like we know, you know? So to have knowledge of both, I think is a very valuable thing. And so when I saw you speak about this, I'm like, thank God someone's pushing this forward. You know, people need to listen, you know, because, you know, there's nothing worse than people throwing in money on a film that doesn't make any. And now we all got a bad rap that there's no money to be made in independent film. You know, it's like, how can we turn that around? So, you know, I'm always about the opposite. Go small. Go as small as you can. The more you're restrained, the more creative you're going to be. You know, the more things you have, the more they're going to be less creative and you're going to make a big pile of crap.
No, exactly. And that, like I used my movie On the Corner of Ego and Desire, the one I shot at Sundance. I made that movie for about $3,000, you know, and it is an experimental film. I mean, I shot a movie in 4 days. That's experimental. Like, I couldn't in good conscience spent $50,000 on that movie.
Right.
You know, and it's a fairly niche movie. I mean, it's a niche movie for a niche audience, which are filmmakers, which is an audience that I have and cultivated and could easily sell that movie to that audience. But I still wouldn't spend $50,000 on it. It just doesn't make financial sense. The ROI is not there. Could I make $50,000 off of it? Could I make $100,000? Possibly, no question. But I'd rather make it for $3,000 and make $20,000 and I'd be like, man, I killed it. Yep. You know?
Exactly.
And then let's not even talk about the other revenue streams that come off of that movie, whether it's consulting, whether it's other opportunities, whether it's books, whether it's – like there's so many other revenue streams that are coming off that movie that's not directly about the exploitation of the film itself, which I also believe is the future of independent film. It is to be able to control revenue streams, diversify those revenue streams as much as humanly possible. And the exploitation of the film itself, if you can make some money with it, great. But it's generally a marketing tool, and this is the model that the music industry has taken on. Like musicians aren't making as much money on music, the sale of music itself, as much as they used to. They're making it everywhere else. Is that correct?
Yeah, not even close. Yeah, exactly. I know a few big ones that they make it on touring and their merchandise.
Yeah, you. I mean, you had one of your documentaries, Off the Boulevard, which we'll talk about in a second. You had Eddie Vedder in there. Do you talk to him about that specific thing? Because I remember Pearl Jam specifically, for people who don't know and are much younger than you or I, Pearl Jam was one of the biggest bands of the 90s. And they were really – like they fought the system hard. And they fought Ticketmaster, they fought the whole music industry, and they kind of went on their own way and they started to build out their own business model. But tell me, what do you know about – I'm fascinated to know how they've been able to continue what they do, because they're artists. They make money with their products and their music. How do they do it? What do you know about it?
Well, yeah. They have a huge warehouse in Seattle, and yeah, they're their own company now. I mean – they still, from their name, they're gonna sell in the big, you know, in the big stores, but they control everything, you know. And Eddie said, man, he says, you know, we go on tour, it's the merch that makes it for us. You know, we break even on what we sell for tickets. Mm-hmm. You know, it's changed. But before, they had albums coming out, and it'd be like, oh, look how good our album's doing. They go out and tour to sell the album. It's the opposite now. They go out on tour to sell the merch. Mm-hmm. You know. And keep it rolling.
And the album sells the tour.
Right on. Exactly. 100%. Way different, you know. And so, but they're at the top of the heap, but they are independent at the top of the heap. You know, their merch that they have at their warehouse it's unbelievable. It's nonstop, you know. And Eddie, you know, he's such a great guy that, you know, he helps charities, you know, so they're involved in the community too, you know. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. they're an anomaly of a band, really. But it's tough in that world, and the same with the independent world, man. You know, like I say to these independent filmmakers, you know, you got to really hone your craft. You know, and don't jump into it right away, because I think we all jump into it quick. We all get a little delusional to start with. That's how you go on this path. But then you got to get real and you gotta bring it back. You know, you gotta listen, and you gotta collaborate. You know, we're all born with different perspectives. Okay, so
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So really, you know, it's about that, and I just hope, you know, that people, because, you know, Alex, there's so many film schools now that these kids are paying.
Don't get me started.
Some money to
don't
go.
Don't get me started.
You know, they think they're going to be the next, you know, John.
Okay, so let me. I'm going to put it out there right now, and I've said this multiple times. Look, I speak and I teach at colleges all the time, and that's great, and there is a place for them, but I think that in today's world, if a filmmaker is spending $60,000, $70,000, $40,000, $50,000, or I know people who are spending $120,000 on film schools, that's debt that you will never be able to get out. And look, if you can afford it, God bless, go do it. It's fun. It's great. I had a great time in my film school. My film right. school cost $18,000, and it was a year, and I had paid it back within 4 or 5 years. It was paid back, but. When you walk into this business, and this is the real truth, and please back me up on this, Jeff. The real truth is when you walk into this business, it's going to take you 4 to 5 years to start making any sort of serious money that you can live off of. If you're in LA, it can even be longer. But it's going to take you a while to be able to start generating real revenue, unless you get a job somewhere or something like, you know, that you're lucky enough to get that. But when you were starting, you know, you're a little bit older than I am. No offense, mm-hmm. but I'm not. But by the way, I'm not that far off. Yeah. But so our generations, the competition was a lot less. Like I graduated college in '96, and in '96 there was still money flying everywhere. There was just a lot of money flowing around still, and the competition for editors, which is where I came in up the ranks in post, was minimal. In today's world, it's almost impossible to generate revenue like that unless you're able to create certain scenarios and businesses and and do multiple things. You can't just be one thing. You have to be 50 things to be able to generate a living. You're going to take a long time for you to develop that. And and you're going to have this debt, this albatross around your neck that you can never get rid of. I think the ROI on a film school education in today's world, depending on the cost, it doesn't make any sense.
I'm with you, man. I really am. And, you know, I don't want to be discouraging to young filmmakers. You know, I want to, you know, give as much advice that takes them down a road where they don't have to go through the pains that others have gone through. I mean, that's what happens when you get older. You want to help someone who's younger that doesn't go through the same stuff you've gone through. But I agree with you on that. I think, you know, coming out to L.A. or New York, you know, you like I said, you got to hone the craft, actor, director, DP, you know, find a position and get a job doing it first. You know what I mean? And rather than just going out and trying to be something before you have any kind of experience, it's tough to do. You know, it really is. And you just get lost with it. But I think that's the different part now. People could come out and do that before, but now I would be more reserved than to say, get your feet wet, get to know the business a little bit, because it's changing so much that I think the streaming part of it is, you know, it's kind of the doorway to independent now, because I think Netflix and these places will take a good script and look at it. You know, if the person comes out of a nice school and maybe they're getting into film school because they wrote a nice script that got them in, that path I would go with.
It's a lottery ticket. Look, to get a development deal out of Netflix, which they're not doing that kind of stuff. They're not taking unknown quantities. They're not taking those risks. They're taking people who have at least one film, and if they have a certain kind of film, they'll maybe give them some money to do a second one and so on. And, you know, Netflix is not in the business of taking the film school student who had a cool short film and giving them $10 million to go make a movie. That's not the business that Netflix or any of these streaming platforms are. But if they make one big hit movie that maybe made no money, but the guy or the girl has a voice, I've interviewed those filmmakers, and Netflix is giving those filmmakers a chance. But things are changing daily. So what was true 6 months ago is not true today. in Netflix world. And like, I sold my first film to Hulu 2 years ago. That I can't sell that movie today. Hulu's not buying. Literally, they've stopped buying because Disney took control of Hulu after they bought Fox. So that stopped. Like, there is no – it's kind of like you're walking, but every time you walk, the ground shifts in front of you. Where you thought it was solid ground is now is moving. And sometimes there's daggers there. And sometimes there's a hole there.
A lot of them. A big chasm. No doubt about it.
Yeah. And that's what I'm preaching so loudly. And that's why I wrote the book that I did, because I want filmmakers to understand that you have to understand the marketplace. You have to understand the ever-changing marketplace. And if you're making a movie with the mentality of 5 years ago, you're dead.
Yeah, you're dead. And it's more going back to Robert Rodriguez and how he did it. You have to show your filmmaking skills.
Yeah.
And then people are going to notice. And to do that is to do it again, like you have preached, Alex, to do it with the least amount of money possible.
Yep.
And I talk about restraints. Have restraints so that mm-hmm. you become more creative. Find a good team that are dedicated, you know, but not everyone's going to climb the ladder with you. You got to have a vision. You got to be original. And I think the first thing is try and be the best filmmaker you can before you become one. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, you got to do the work before you get the work. You know, and so that's just the reality of the film business. Or go into the film business and get a job within the film business. Whether you want to go into TV, then try and be an assistant as a writer or something.
Mm-hmm,
but,
mm-hmm.
you know, but the real true off-the-grid ones, I still want those people to succeed, obviously. We do, you know, but the way for that to happen is that you got to have a film community. You know, someone has to build it, you know, and I hope one day it gets built. Because there's a lot of money out there, and there's good filmmakers everywhere, I believe. You know, the guy in Kansas, he's just not getting the opportunity, you know. Mm-hmm. And so how can you have a community that could give opportunity to these people that are really dedicated to be something special, you know. And that's one thing I hope that happens, you know. But do not go out there and put a lot of money into something that you don't have an experience at. Please don't. It hurts everybody.
Preach, my friend, preach. Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all of my guests, sir. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Didn't I just say it?
I think you just said it. Like when you were saying earlier, like we all get delusional. I mean, I think we have to be a little delusional just to walk into this business, don't we?
Oh, you have to be. Yeah, you have to. But right now what's going on with all the social media, everyone wants to be famous. So you got to dial it back. You know, and you got to be real about this, seriously, and find a way to be different. You know, that's the one, originality, man. You know, because you know, be a rhinestone cowboy. You know, there's
wow, I you have dated yourself, and you've dated me because I know that reference.
Yeah, it's a load of compromising, man, and hustle's the name of the game. We're all singing the same old song, that's for sure.
Okay. So,
you know, but it really comes down to that, you know, because if you have a good idea, you know, covet it and figure out how to tell it. Okay. Everyone has a story inside them. I believe that. That's what got me going. You know, I came from a baseball world. You know, I wanted to be a baseball player. I didn't have the talent my dad had. So I'm like, oh, okay, where's my dream now? You know, and I forged ahead, and I have a lot. I've had a lot of lumps, you know, and, you know, I still struggle at times. You know, I'm coming out. I'm back in L.A. again with my wife as a writing partner, you know, trying to go to another level in TV, you know,
we've been infected, sir. We've been infected. You can't get rid of it. There's no vaccination for this disease that we have, this filmmaking disease. I mean, no matter how often we're beat up, it flares up.
Yeah, there's no doubt. It's nothing else I'm going to be doing. That's for sure.
Right. And I've tried. I'm sure you've tried too. You've tried to leave this horrible mistress who just beats you, but for whatever reason, you love it. You love it. Yeah. You come back to it. You know, I went to sell olive oil for 3 years, and that's a whole other conversation.
I managed a restaurant. You know, I've done a lot of stuff, man. And I tell you, yeah, there's nothing. The freedom of doing your own thing is beautiful. You know,
but there is no business like show business. But
right?
Please don't forget the word business.
Yeah, business. That's it. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson said it a long time ago, man. And I was making my film right around the time PTA started with his film. And, you know, that guy's a beautiful filmmaker.
Oh.
And, you know, he said, you know, you got to know it's 50-50, creative and business. If you don't mm-hmm. know the business side, you got no shot. Because if you can't communicate the right way, if you know, people are going to notice right away, like, okay, he doesn't really know what's going on here. So right then you're kind of pushed to the side, and you have to work with people. You know, you can't just come in like a bully. You have to collaborate, and that takes time. That mm-hmm. takes time of who are the right people to collaborate with. You mm-hmm. know, you still make mistakes picking the wrong people to help out, you know, at times. Mm-hmm. It gets frustrating, man. I want the younger generation to do well because it's exciting where things are going. Mm-hmm. But it is dramatically changing.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh, man. Wow. Is to not be overly passionate at times. It could scare people away, in my case. I felt like you got to pace yourself. You know, I've put myself in situations where my health didn't turn out so well because I was just so determined to get something done. And you got to surround yourself with really good people, good mm-hmm. people that you trust and they trust you. And that's hard, man. That's really hard. Yeah, I'm talking about off the grid stuff, you know, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. finding a project that has a powerful main character, like a story, like the two films that really succeeded for me had really two powerful main characters in them behind the story, you know, that they had their own history with. So really find that niche. And it just took me a long time to know, like, I'm okay with myself now. You know, it's weird. It's like I happens, man. And I got a beautiful wife and I love creating with her, and whatever comes our way comes our way. And if it doesn't, we're working our butts off to make it come our way.
Isn't it funny that that's something that you could only get with age? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just like, you know, I'm good with whatever shows up. I'm good with, like, hey, you know, if it doesn't work out, we'll just keep rolling. And that kind of, I don't say the word confidence, but just the okayness of that, it took me years to learn. I mean, it took me years to figure that out. And then now I'm in the same boat as you are. I'm just like, you know, if I'm just going to roll. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. If it happens, it happens. And you just keep pushing. You keep grinding and you keep enjoying that journey. And it's what it's all about, honestly. And not being too precious about things.
That's it, man. And you know, that's what I saw in you when my wife and I watched you. I said, man, this guy's grounded, man, and he's put a lot of work in. And
I appreciate that.
What you're doing though is a beautiful voice that we need, you know. And I had it for a while, and then I said, okay, I got to go underground again, right? You know, it's like, it's killing me, you know. But you come out better, and you know, making a film. If you can make a film and better yourself by making that film, meaning your character, that's a beautiful film. You know, I've had people get married on films that I've made. You know, I met my wife on a film that I wish I never made. You know, so, you know, it's stuff like that that you go, okay, there's a meaning behind it, you know? Not that, you know, everything's a reason for everything. There's a meaning, but you can put a meaning behind where you're going. And that really helps your psyche. And you know, I just feel like, yeah, you don't know what's happening right now in the business, but I'm here and I think I'm at my best I've ever been. I hope mm-hmm. I don't get too old, you know, but I have a younger wife that balances me out. So, you know,
hey, that's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah. And the film female perspective, you know, a lot of things are changing that you have to change with them. You gotta mix it up, you know, and say, okay, this old way I did things doesn't work anymore. I got to go a new way, and you gotta be open to it.
Absolutely. And now, what are three of your favorite films of all time?
Oh, well, Thief
yes.
is my number one because that got me into wanting to be a filmmaker. I love Michael Mann. Mm-hmm. I love that film because it was so gritty and it was so real.
So
James Caan, Tuesday Wells were so good. So that's one. I have to say, you know, we all go to the Scorsese, and I love Scorsese. I love Michael Mann, and the third filmmaker. Oh God, why am I losing his name? Back, he did Diner.
Oh, Oh God! Oh God! Yeah, well, Diner's a fantastic film, by the way.
Yeah, well, he's done, but I followed those guys for a long time, and mm-hmm. and then obviously fell in love with what Tarantino has done, and Paul Thomas Anderson, all these guys. But I would say True Romance was another one that I loved.
Oh, I loved Tony Scott was. I miss Tony. I miss Tony, man. I so miss him.
You know that was a great movie written by Quentin Tarantino. Obviously I got to put my baseball, The Natural, in there just because I just want to put that on and go, okay, you never know what's going to happen in life, man. The older you get, if you just stay in the game, you might get another shot, you know?
So. I'll put on The Natural and I'll just play the final scene. the final scene is just because it's so amazing.
It really is beautiful.
So, now, where can people find you?
Those three right there.
And where can people find you and your work and your films?
Santo Films. I have a website that we sell our films on. So that's easy. SantoFilms.com. So that's where they can go. I got all my – and also DeadAndFiveHeartbeats.com is another film that I'm selling on our movie website, Dead and Five Heartbeats. But Santo Films will take you where you want to go. And –
man, Jeff, I have to tell you, Jeff, we could probably talk these two old salty dogs could talk about film another few hours. But I do appreciate you taking the time and dropping the knowledge bombs on the tribe. And hopefully this episode will help at least one filmmaker avoid one of those big cavernous holes that we talked about in the episode. So thank you so much for sharing, man. I appreciate it. DVD is dead, right, guys? That's what everyone says. But no, there is still a very large audience out there who buys and watch DVDs all the time. It is still a way to generate revenue, specifically if you know your niche audience and how to get to them. Now, I want to thank Jeff for coming on and inspiring the tribe today. It's always great to hear an independent filmmaker who has worked outside of the system and is doing very, very well, actually building a business, building a career outside of the traditional path. And I hope his story has inspired you guys. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/069. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to filmbizpodcast.com and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening. As always, be that filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.